This is the BBC World Service. You're listening to Outlook with me, Frederick Dove. Today, the Canadian teacher whose video recording of a confrontation between Canadian police and a newly arrived immigrant at Vancouver Airport has shocked a nation. Also coming up, the former dishwasher who's become Switzerland's first black member of parliament. In Canada, a video clip just a few minutes long has sparked off a major national controversy and several official inquiries. The video, recorded by teacher Paul Pritchard, has been watched online by millions of Canadians. It shows the final minutes in the life of Robert Jikanski, a Polish man who'd flown in from Europe to Vancouver Airport in Western Canada. He died after causing a disturbance and being confronted in the arrivals area by officers of the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who tried to subdue him with electric shocks from a taser gun. Covering the story has been Vancouver-based journalist Carolyn Jack.
Mr. Jikanski was essentially lost inside the airport for about 10 and a half hours. He did go through immigration. We're not certain of the exact timing of that yet, but there are hours that are unaccounted for where he's behind the scenes and nobody seems to know where he is. His mother goes home believing he has not arrived. She's told that by airport officials. Eventually, Mr. Jikanski gets to the front of the arrival area, which has glass doors which open and close automatically. He's clearly very distressed. You see him on the video. He is sweating profusely. He is emotional. Someone tries to calm him down, tries many different languages on him, none of which he speaks. He is frustrated. He throws down a small foldable table. A few moments later, four RCMP officers arrive. They walk through the doors. You clearly hear on the tape one officer say, "Permission to taser." And about 24 seconds later, Mr. Jikanski is tasered and writhing in agony on the ground. You can see that the RCMP officers are on top of his back and on his neck. There is some theory out there now that what may have killed Mr. Jikanski may be that his breathing was restricted. So we don't yet know what killed him. We know that when we are watching that tape, you hear them say code red, and Mr. Jikanski sadly is dead.
And since this has all emerged, I mean, it's caused a huge, huge stir in Canada.
I think there's probably at least three reasons for this. I think the first is that the power of the image has amazing force. You are watching a man die on video. Robert Jikanski is on the ground screaming in pain, having been tasered. So it was very compelling imagery. I think that's the first thing. It was broadcast on every national television news network, on every local network here in British Columbia. It got very wide coverage. It was on YouTube within seconds. So huge impact in terms of the visual image. What Canadians were watching was a man who was coming to Canada. And Canadian self-image is very much one of, we see ourselves as the nice guys in the world. I'm not saying that necessarily factually in every instance that might be accurate, but that is a strong image in the minds of Canadians. And so what they were actually watching, when you know the story, is a man who wanted to become a Canadian, came here to be a Canadian, and didn't ever make it out the door of the airport.
And more from Carolyn Jack shortly. I've also been talking to Paul Pritchard, the teacher who recorded the confrontation between Robert Jikanski and the police. Paul Pritchard joined me from his home city of Victoria on Vancouver Island, and I asked him why he'd been at Vancouver Airport.
Actually, I was on a return flight home from China. My dad had fallen quite ill, and I was on an emergency flyback, and I had a layover in San Francisco for 5 hours. And as I was waiting, for some strange reason, I fell asleep. And I fell asleep for 20 minutes. And I fell asleep right as my plane was boarding. And when I woke up, I ran to the gate and they said, "Sorry, we just pulled your bags off. You've just missed your flight." And that was that. And I was kind of stuck in San Francisco. Luckily, they got me on the last seat on a late flight that night, which got me into Vancouver later than it takes for me to get my ferry back to Victoria, so I had to sleep in the airport in Vancouver.
Why then did you start filming this Polish man who was by the looks of the video, clearly very distressed and sort of unable to actually leave. Why did you actually start filming him?
It was actually it was due to lack of security. So I was watching him with the other passengers for about 20 minutes. And we had called security a couple times, and they just haven't responded by this time. So once he got swiped into the secured area, so once he was behind those glass doors that you see in the video, that's where I said, okay, you know, this is actually serious. Now he's in a secured area. Why aren't I filming this? And I went and grabbed my camera.
Had you started filming him because you thought something was going to happen?
Yes, I mean, just because it had gone so long without anything happening, I thought, you know, and it just kind of clicked into me that I had my camera with me. I've been traveling for a couple of years. I always have my camera with me, and I've kind of learned to always just grab my camera in situations where things aren't always normal.
What did you think was happening? I mean, you were watching this, obviously, through the lens of your camera. What did you think was happening there?
We all had our own opinions, but we definitely thought, you know, a couple of people guessed that he was lost and didn't know where he was going, and we thought he was just distressed, maybe had some sort of mental problem. When you see him, he just looks very, very scared.
Well, he's walking backwards and forwards, isn't he? And
he's
clearly disorientated, confused.
Mm-hmm, exactly, and I mean, he was giving no physical threat to us. At no point did we feel we were in danger. One of the ladies at one point went up to him and tried to calm him down. You see that on the video.
And were there any airport officials who came up to him and tried to talk to him?
No, nothing. Nobody. Nobody from the airport.
And at this point, where you film him, was he basically in a place where he could have just walked out of the airport?
Yes. Well, I was in the international arrival lobby, and so was he. And what woke me up was him banging on the door. So he was in the lobby with me, but he was trying to get back into the security area where immigration is. So it turns out that's where he was supposed to meet his mom. And that's where he spent, you know, 6 hours waiting for his mother there. And he eventually came back into my area, which leads out of the airport, realized his mother wasn't there, and just tried to get back in.
While you were filming what turned out to be the last moments of Mr. Jakansky at Vancouver Airport, what was going through your mind? I mean, you were watching, obviously, what was happening through your camera. Did you think of intervening? Did you feel uncomfortable watching what you were watching?
While I was filming, it was kind of for an entertainment. I mean, it's in an airport. You don't usually see this sort of thing. And it wasn't very serious. And once the police arrived, I mean, there was four officers, and that's when I kind of hit home, okay, uh-oh, this might turn into something. Keep the camera going. Once the police got to Mr. Jakansky, and I mean, they used the taser within 25 seconds of them arriving, the audio of the sound of the taser, the zapping, and it, we stopped talking at that point, and it was just, it really made it real. And then when you hear him scream, I mean, it went from beyond entertainment, it went to a serious, serious thing that was going on.
Were you just by this stage on autopilot, or were you now consciously filming what you knew was a serious news event?
I knew it was a serious news event, and I only had, you know, a couple minutes of memory left, so I was trying to conserve the memory, but I knew definitely that something happened, and I needed to keep this camera going.
And you filmed this for quite a number of minutes. At what point, then, did you have your video confiscated?
Well, I got 10 minutes of footage, and I'd stopped filming right before the medics arrived, and I didn't want to turn the camera on once they started administering CPR. And it was about half an hour, 40 minutes after the incident, after he had deceased, the officers came to me and realized that I had a video. I waited there for 4 hours for homicide or the detectives to come who were investigating it. And we did a full statement, and they asked if they could get a copy of my footage, and I agreed. I had no reason to hold anything from them. And the original plan was to go down to the station and get a copy done there. And so I waited for 4 hours. I'm all ready to go, and at the last minute they say, oh, you know, the guy isn't there tonight, or we don't have the right computer there tonight. Do you mind if we just take it? And they assured me, you know, within 48 hours, don't worry, we'll get it back to you. And so I handed it over to them.
And then what happened?
Well, they phoned me the next day and informed me that they will give my camera back in a new memory stick, but we're keeping the footage.
The reason being?
It was going to interfere with the investigation. Because there's an investigation going on, we need to take it. And, you know, at this point, I didn't know the law. I didn't know my rights. I felt pretty belittled at this point. And that's when I phoned a lawyer just to get some legal advice. You know, are they allowed to do this? He told me they're not. We wrote them a letter saying, you know, give me back my footage. On what legal grounds do you have to take it? And, you know, they responded that night, okay, don't worry, we're going to give it back, no problem, sorry for the inconvenience. So I thought it was all over, and they called me late that night and left a message on my lawyer's answer machine saying, sorry, Mr. Pritchard, but we have to retract our last statement. We just can't give it back to you.
So this was turning into a legal battle over your ownership of your video cassette.
That's exactly what it turned into. It pushed me to believe that for what reason wouldn't they give it back to me? And that's what made me believe maybe there was something on that videotape that they didn't want getting out to the public. And that's what pushed me even harder to take the next step.
Which was?
Take them to court.
So how long was it in the end between handing over your camera and the cassette and getting it back?
I believe it was about 3 weeks. And on the fourth week is when it finally came back and I released it.
And you had to go all the way to court to get it back?
And I had to go to court twice to get it back.
And what's your reaction then to the stir that the incident, but of course above all, your video of the incident has caused?
It's pretty surreal. I mean, I had no idea it would become so internationally huge, especially nationally huge in my own country. I just had no idea, and it's still pretty surreal to me.
I was talking there to Canadian teacher Paul Pritchard, who, as I heard from journalist Carolyn Jack, has found himself very much in the spotlight since he recorded what happened at Vancouver Airport.
It's been fascinating. He's actually become a kind of folk hero in Canada. There's a Facebook site putting his name forward for a Governor General's Award for Courage. That's the highest honor you can get for courage in Canada.
Meanwhile, of course, at the heart of all this is the man who died at Vancouver Airport, Mr. Chikansky. What response has there been from the authorities? Because, I mean, this is far from over, isn't it?
It's a long way from over. There are a slew of inquiries, frankly, for journalists and others here. It's hard to keep track of them all. We're looking ahead to a coroner's inquest in May, which should hopefully tell us what happened to Mr. Zakansky and what was his cause of death. There's official public inquiries by the government, by the RCMP. There's members of parliament in Ottawa who are having an inquiry. There is considerable investigation into what happened in the Vancouver airport and whether or not tasers are safe.
And what about at Vancouver, meanwhile? Have procedures changed there?
There was the announcement that Canadian Border Services made recently that they were going to change some things about what happened with new arrivals, that they need more staff on site, more language abilities on site, that kind of thing. So that has been announced. We're waiting very much on hearing the results of investigations that the RCMP are doing into the incident. We have no idea when those will come forward. You know, we've got a long way to go yet in terms of, you know, what changes might ultimately come.
And that was journalist Carolyn Jack, who joined me from Vancouver in Western Canada. And we contacted the Canada Border Services Agency for their comments on what happened to Robert Chikansky at Vancouver Airport. And we have received an email which says, quote, although the CBSA strives to respond to email inquiries in the shortest delay possible, it may take up to 60 days for a response to be provided due to the large volume of emails received. Unquote. And when we hear back from the Canada Border Services Agency, we'll let you know what they say. Coming up later, what's it like being a foreign rebel living in the heart of the South American jungle? We'll find out when we hear revealing extracts from the recently discovered diary of a Dutch woman fighting for rebels in Colombia. You're listening to Outlook with me, Frederick Dove, and this is the BBC World Service. After Switzerland's recent elections, the country's new parliament convenes for the first time this week. Overshadowing the elections was a controversy over the alleged racism in a campaign poster by the SVP, the Swiss People's Party, which showed three white sheep kicking a black sheep off the Swiss flag. The SVP, following the elections, remains the biggest party, but the Swiss parliament now also has its first black member. Newly elected Ricardo Lumengo is a refugee from Angola, After coming to Switzerland, he studied law while washing dishes, amongst other jobs. He's now an MP for the Social Democrats. Ricardo Lumengo has been talking to Heather Payton about Switzerland's recent election controversy and first about why he left Angola in the early 80s.
When I left Angola, it was a civil war in Angola. And also in the same time, there were no freedom of liberty of the expression or liberty of meeting, of making some group or political groups, things like this. And me, when I was 17 years old, I became member of the youth section of the party in the power. And after some years, I took part in another tendency inside the party. Persons were criticizing the government. We wanted democracy. We were against the war. And in Angola in that time, when you are criticizing the regime, you are saying some things what is against the regime, and then you are persecuted. You have problem with the intelligence service of the party, all that. It was dangerous for me in that time. That's why I decided then to go away.
So how easy was it for you to leave Angola and go to Switzerland?
It's necessary to have some contact with people to tell you that even you must leave, and to know also people who are working here, in the airport, in different service. That's why I succeeded. But in general, it was not easy, especially in that time in Angola, because the government did not allow people to leave the country and going abroad.
So you managed to get to Switzerland. You arrived there. What was it like for you then?
When I come in Switzerland, in general, I can say that it was good in that time. I used to say it that the condition of living, being someone who came for asylum, in general, it was good. It could help someone exactly to build, to make another new life.
But a very different country, of course, from Angola. Did it seem strange to you?
Yes, different in many sides, I can say it. The weather, the construction, how people behave, all that, there are things that are different, exactly.
But you studied for a law degree. How did you manage that financially?
It was not easy. Then I had to do some small jobs. I did, I think, 2 years when I came, just working here, working in a restaurant, like we call it in German, Tellerwäscher, someone who's just for washing the plates. It helped me to make some money outside, and with this money, I decided then to start studying. But also, unfortunately, it could not go along, and after, I think, 8-9 months, and the financial difficulty started, and that's why I had to work. First, I found a job like a student. I found a job in the evening. After studying, I was going to a fabric.
This was a job in a factory, was it?
Yes, in factory, mm-hmm. And then working 3 hours in the morning till 6 hours, mm-hmm. And then after going to the university at 8 hours, it was very, very difficult. That's why I consider that I was a student who studied a long time before I closed my studies. Normally, my friends, my colleagues, they have done minimum 5 years, and me, I did twice because of financial difficulties.
How easy, though, was it for you to integrate into Swiss society?
I think I was lucky. For me, it was not so very, very difficult. I think because of many factors, religion, being a Christian, it was simple also to have contact with some people also, and also because of the language. Before coming in Switzerland, I could already speak French. It helped it also, the contact, the integration.
Did you ever think at that point in your life that you would be a member of the Swiss Parliament?
No. I did not think to it, because even when I was leaving Angola, I came here with the task, the objective, to continue to be politically active for seeking for a change, a democracy in Angola, to fight against the war in Angola. When you are abroad, I think you are far from this persecution. You have more possibility to fight. Our objective was that we must look for a change in Angola, but not through the war, but through a peaceful way. And this one also we succeed with it because 1992, there were a peace in Angola and also a plan of the free democratic election was established.
The election campaign, of course, in October last month, made a lot of headlines internationally, largely because of its nature. And in particular, I'm thinking of the poster that featured a black sheep being kicked off the flag by white sheep. And there's also, of course, been talk that there'll be laws that would make it much tougher for immigrants. How did that campaign make you feel?
For me, I was worrying about it. I think that for everybody, I was disappointed. I could not agree with such kind of campaign. It's clear that anyway, any explanation, any interpretation one can give to such kind of campaign, but it's clear that the image are there, and I see this poster, they were showing an idea of the exclusion. And especially when we are seeing that in Switzerland, and an exclusion of foreigners, and particularly of black, that is symbolizing with these black sheep.
Did you feel almost that you were being targeted personally, that it was aimed at you?
Personally, being foreigners and then black, I can say that I was thinking that it's touched me in this way. I can say that I was concerned.
But nonetheless, you were elected, although a lot of people in your party lost their seats. What do you think your election means for Switzerland?
The meaning is, through my election, it's clear that there is another Switzerland, a Switzerland of tolerance, a Switzerland of the open Switzerland, and not a Switzerland of exclusion, like this poster was showing.
So do you think this is actually quite good news for Switzerland?
Yes, it's symbolical, historical, good news. Everybody recognizes it, yes.
And that was Ricardo Lumengo, the Angolan refugee who now sits in the Swiss Parliament as the country's first black MP. And he represents the Social Democrat Party. He was talking to Heather Payton. Following our recent report on growing demands for cosmetic surgery among women in Kenya, we found an email from Israel Ambe Ayongwa in Bamenda, Cameroon. And he says, this universal move by women, including those of the continent of Africa, for cosmetic surgery is not natural and not normal. That is called artificial beauty, and I don't think after undergoing such a process, these women should expect to be placed on the same pedestal with those who are truly beautiful. Until the definition of beauty is changed, they are not beautiful, according to me. And so says Israel Ambe Ayongwa in Bamenda, Western Cameroon. And if you have anything to say on anything you hear in the programme, our email address, as always, is outlook@bbc.co.uk.
BBC. Wally Soyinka.
Those who were capable of a deed that revolted even the most elastic sectors of the public conscience, what else were they capable of?
Anora O'Neill.
Demands for universal transparency are, I believe, likely to encourage either self-censorship or deception.
And Jeffrey Sachs.
Our generation's unique challenge is learning to live in an extraordinarily crowded world.
As the BBC marks 75 years of global broadcasting, three Reith lecturers debate freedom of speech in the world today. Get the background to the debate and the speakers at bbcworldservice.com. The Reith Global Debate, Sunday at 14 CET.
Free to speak. 75 years of the BBC World Service.
At bbcworldservice.com, you can join in a global conversation. Log on to bbcworldservice.com and choose World Have Your Say from the list of programmes.
This month, the BBC World Service marks its 75th anniversary by focusing on freedom of speech. And on Outlook, our focus will be protest slogans. And coming up after the latest news, we'll hear what slogans have been popular in the run-up to Sunday's controversial referendum in Colombia.
BBC News with Ian Purton. President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela has narrowly lost a referendum which would have radically changed the way the country is governed and given him the option of seeking re-election as many times as he wished. It's the first electoral setback for the president since he came to power in 1998 and follows warnings that the changes would have amounted to a constitutional coup. International observers monitoring Sunday's parliamentary election in Russia say the poll was not conducted fairly. Two democracy and human rights organisations, the OSCE and the Council of Europe, said the process fell short of democratic standards. With almost all the votes now counted, the United Russia Party, led by President Vladimir Putin, has won almost two-thirds of the votes cast. The British schoolteacher Gillian Gibbons, who was jailed for insulting Islam, has been pardoned by the Sudanese president and handed over to British embassy officials. She's due to leave Sudan within the day. Mrs. Gibbons had been sentenced to 15 days in prison in Khartoum for allowing her pupils to name a teddy bear Mohammed. The Congolese army has gone on the offensive in the east of the country using helicopter gunships and heavy artillery against the rebel leader Laurent Nkunda. United Nations peacekeepers say the government has launched an offensive against the town of Mushake, a rebel stronghold 40 kilometres northwest of the regional capital, Goma. A new British parliamentary report warns that British troops could leave the southern Iraqi city of Basra without having established security. Britain is planning to hand control of the city to Iraqi forces later this month, but the report says serious questions remain about the true allegiance of Iraqi forces. Police in the southwestern Pakistani province of Balochistan say six children have been killed and a number of others seriously injured in an explosion at an Islamic religious seminary or madrasa. No one so far has admitted causing the blast. BBC News.
This is the BBC World Service. I'm Frederick Dove and you're listening to Outlook. Coming up, what a group of American stand-up comedians, all of them themselves Muslim, make of the news that a British teacher in Sudan has been sentenced to jail for allowing her young pupils to call the class teddy bear Mohammed.
It's ridiculous. I mean, come on. It's a bunch of kids. Kids have this imagination. If the kids want to call the bear Mohammed, one of the most popular names in the world, if not the most popular name in the world, the intentions of the teacher, from what we have seen, is a positive intention. She's in the Sudan, for God's sakes, teaching, where she could be living a life of leisure here in Britain.
In Colombia, officials have just released videos and photos recently seized from captured left-wing rebels of several high-profile hostages. It's the first evidence in 4 years that these hostages are still alive. Meanwhile, the discovery earlier this year of a rebel diary in Colombia has made headlines all the way across the Atlantic in the Netherlands. The diary writer was Tanya Neymeyer, a Dutch woman who a few years ago joined Colombia's left-wing rebel group, the FARC. But as her diary, written in Dutch, reveals, Neymeyer isn't entirely happy about her life as a rebel deep in the South American jungle. I asked Dutch journalist Edwin Koopman, who's just returned to the Netherlands from Colombia, how this revealing diary came to light.
It took about 3 months before they were public. Don't forget that the diaries were written in Dutch. So, first of all, the Colombian army had to translate the diaries into Spanish to understand what was written there. And then obviously they were studied and they made some selections to look which part would be the most appropriate to publish or to be leaked.
How much is known about Tanya Neymeyer? She's from the Netherlands. We know that. She's in her late 20s. What's her background?
Well, she's coming from just a middle-class family in the northeast of the Netherlands. She went to study in the University of Groningen, and then after a couple of years, she went to Colombia just on a trip and started to do some volunteering work in poor suburbs in the cities in Colombia. And then she became engaged with the poor and with the problems in Colombia, and that's how it all started.
And does anybody know whether she is one of very few Europeans who are with the FARC or whether there are many with the FARC?
Well, according to the Colombian Secret Service and the Colombian Army, there seem to be about 10 or 15 or 20, they're not sure about it, but let's say a couple of tens of European persons active in the FARC. So If we see that this FARC guerrilla group is about 14 or 15,000 fighters, then we could talk about a quite exceptional case, especially in the case of Tanya, because if we look at the Spanish, Swedish and Danish people active in the FARC, they basically have activities like translations, working in the international internet site, so doing all kinds of jobs where they can use their knowledge of another language. This is not the case with Tanya. Tanya went straight to the jungle to just pick up an arm and join the fight. This is really rare.
Well, stay with us, Edmund. We're going to hear some of these translated extracts now from Tanya Nehemiah's diary. Here's the first one.
The 21st of July, 2006. I'm obsessed with train stations. I often imagine I'm in the station in Groningen, Amsterdam, or Utrecht. I buy a coffee or some chips and get on board. I almost forgot the big news. Two comrades have AIDS, and there may be more. No one here uses contraceptives. The girlfriend of one of the men has no idea what it means. She told me the news with a big grin, and her boyfriend seems totally unconcerned. Another girl, who used to have a relationship with a man, is really worried now. The 23rd of August, 2006. I managed to ring home, but I didn't get permission beforehand, and now Fritz is mad at me too. But I don't care. It was wonderful to hear their voices. Mom started crying, and then Dad did too. Now I just have to patiently wait for my punishment. Everyone can ring home except me. Isn't that ridiculous? Maybe they'll leave me behind in the jungle forever. Or maybe they'll send me on a foreign mission after this little disobedience. Actually, I don't want to. It doesn't interest me. I might have a new boyfriend. A commandant. He is 30 years old and very special. Maybe it'll work out between us.
And more extracts from Tanya Nehemiah's diary shortly. And still with us is Edwin Koopman in the Netherlands. Edwin, we're talking here about a woman in her late 20s who's joined a revolutionary group, and yet this diary sounds really quite mundane, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, this was a very nice part we just heard, because it reveals the two types of topics she's writing about. At the one hand, she's talking about the commanders who keep everything for themselves. And the other topic she talks about is her relationships with guerrilla men when she misses someone who is in another battalion. So these two topics are mixed all the time in her diary.
Well, let's hear another kind of entry now.
Dear Jens, we've been sitting here for 3 days, waiting to shoot down a helicopter that sometimes flies over. I'm beginning to think that it'll never fly past. I've still got the same boyfriend, but I'm beginning to fall in love with someone else. I wish you were here. Give me some advice, Jens. I just don't think I'm capable of staying with one man to any length of time. Jens, I would have left a trail of broken relationships behind me. The 24th of November, 2006. I'm tired. Tired of the FARC, tired of people, and tired of living in this commune. I'm fed up of never having anything of my own. All of this would have a purpose if you knew what you were fighting for. I don't believe in it anymore. What sort of rebel movement is this? Only a few people have money or cigarettes or sweets, and the rest of us have to beg for a share. But you know the higher-ups will just be nasty and say no. It was exactly the same 4 years ago when I joined. Nothing has changed. A girl with big breasts and a pretty face can totally undermine a unit that has worked together for ages. I don't know if I'll ever get out of this jungle. I want to get out of here, at least out of this unit. But you know that you're a sort of prisoner here. It's not the FARC so much as this unit. But I had enough of all that blah, blah, blah of being a communist. All the commandants are corrupt and rabble-rousers and traitors. They've got no sympathy if someone delivers any criticism. I wish I was in a fighting unit.
And that was Tanya Nehemiah writing in her diary, and the diary entries are addressed to her friend Jan Sipsthorpe. And still with us is Edwin Koopman. Edwin, just hearing those extracts from the diary, I mean, there are mixed messages there. On the one hand, you know, she can't wait to shoot down helicopters and have a gun in her hand. On the other hand, she's tired, fed up, irritated, frustrated, and by the sound of it, she wants to leave.
Yeah, well, she says she wants to leave the battalion and go to another place because maybe there's more fighting or more active actions there. But she doesn't say she wants to leave the FARC. She is criticizing all the time the commanders, and in that way, she's behaving, let's say, like a Dutch person, because here we live in a free country where you can say everything, and there you are part of a military structure, and you're not allowed or supposed to give critics.
If she wanted to leave altogether, any indications whether she would be allowed to do that?
Well, a fighter who joins the FARC is warned just from the start that it's for a lifetime. You cannot join the FARC in the jungle and then at a certain moment say, okay, that was it, I am going to leave and I'm going home. So the permission to leave is very difficult, and obviously after the revelations of these diaries, for her it will be impossible.
Now, this diary was found when she and her fellow FARC members left a camp in a hurry. Does anybody know whether the discovery of this diary, and since it's been leaked, whether that would now place her in danger?
Yeah, well, this is a very relevant question, because what she reveals, obviously, as we've heard, is not at all positive for the image of the life with the guerrilla, especially for the commanders, who she describes as selfish and having a lot of privileges, etc. So you would expect her to be punished. Well, I spoke about this to Colombians who know the FARC very well, people from the Ministry of Defense, but also ex-commanders of the FARC, and they agree that if she had been a Colombian girl, she would definitely have been killed by the FARC as a represalia. And also, if the story would have been published only in Colombia, that could have been the case as well. But the fact that she's a foreigner and the fact that this story became an international story may have saved her from such a radical punishment, because the FARC is very worried about its negative international image. And maybe keeping her alive and someday presenting her and maybe defending the FARC again can prove to the world that they treat their foreign fighters very well.
In Colombia itself, after the diary entries were translated, were they a bit of an eye-opener, or did people say, well, we knew this was the life, you know, if you joined the FARC?
Well, in Colombia, it's very clear what's alive in the FARC and what the FARC is all about. I found actually a lot of anger among the Colombians, anger about the fact that a Dutch girl can be so naive to think that the FARC is a sort of Robin Hood-like liberation movement rather than a criminal organization which kidnaps and blackmails all the time and kills. That's the most common reaction I found in Colombia.
And what about in the Netherlands, in Tanya's own country? Have the diary entries caused much of a stir there?
Well, it's been front page news for a couple of weeks. There have been questions in Parliament urging our Dutch government to press the Colombians to be more cautious with the leaking of this kind of information. I'm not sure if the Colombians would respond to this, because for the Colombian government it's been an excellent opportunity to show that the FARC is not functioning very well, that there's a lot of internal critics. So for the Colombian government it's obviously been a very good possibility to show that they are right and that the FARC is wrong.
Dutch journalist Edwin Koopman telling me about a rebel diary written by a Dutch woman which was found earlier this year at an abandoned rebel camp in Colombia. This is Outlook, and I'm Frederick Dove. Later this month, the BBC World Service marks its 75th anniversary with programmes focusing on freedom of speech. On Outlook, we've been inviting you to send us emails and texts about protest slogans. One country where political slogans have been thick in the air in recent days is Venezuela, in the run-up to President Hugo Chavez's controversial referendum on abolishing limits on the length of time the president can stay in office. At the end of last week, before the referendum, I talked to the BBC's James Ingham in the capital, Caracas.
Well, there's various people who are opposed to the President Hugo Chavez and to his government and the reforms that are being proposed here in Venezuela. The opposition political parties have driven it, but as also have the students. The students here at Venezuela's traditional universities have become some of the most vocal opponents against the government, and they've been out on the streets dozens of times over the past few weeks and months to campaign. Some of the protests have turned violent, but most of them have remain peaceful, although there's always been a heavy police and military presence.
What we're particularly interested in today in this case is actually the slogans that the protesters for or against Mr. Chavez's referendum have been chanting.
Well, absolutely. The government has its own slogans which Chavistas, Chavez supporters, use all the time. The main one is Patria Socialismo o Muerte, Venceremos. And this literally means Fatherland Socialism or Death, We Will Not Be Defeated. And this is something that the government uses all the time on its promotional material, in its propaganda, if you like. It's also an oath that the military have to swear by here. There's several others that government supporters use. One of them is La gente unido nunca será vencido. This is the people united never will be defeated. Now, on the other side, the students have got their own chants. A lot of them are talking about how they think that freedom is being eroded. Basic freedoms of speech, basic liberties in Venezuela are being eroded. And there's one that says, who are we, students? What do we want? Freedom. And never will you stop us from protesting.
So that was the chant there by those opposing Mr. Chavez's referendum in Venezuela. Now, James, I gather that it's not just words that the different camps have been sort of chanting at each other. They've also been bursting into song. So I guess you could call these political protest songs.
Absolutely, they are. Protest songs from those opposed to the government. And also the government has come up with its own songs. These songs are designed to be used at marches and demonstrations of support for the government. They're also designed to try to get the people out onto the streets to vote. Let's just hear a little bit of Hugo Chavez singing, mixed into a tune that's heavily heard here at pro-government demonstrations.
Ahora sí, 7-8 años después. Ahora sí con el rumbo bien claro. Ahora sí con el conocimiento mucho más profundo de nuestras realidades. Ahora sí con una experiencia que se va sumando a la pasión y a la voluntad. Ahora sí con rumbo hacia el socialismo, hacia una democracia profunda.
Now, opponents of the government have got their own songs, and you may well remember that just a few weeks ago, President Chavez fell out with the King of Spain quite publicly. The King of Spain used these words, ¿por qué no te callas?, at a conference of leaders in South America. And this literally means, why don't you just shut up? And these words from the King have been mixed into various songs. This is just one use of it at a student demo I was at recently.
Kenyo Tikayas, why don't you shut up? The exasperated words of King Juan Carlos of Spain to President Hugo Chavez turned into a protest song in Venezuela, from where I was joined by the BBC's James Ingham. Now, as far as we're concerned, we don't want you to shut up. Quite the opposite. We want you to speak out about your favourite protest slogans. The email address is outlook@bbc.co.uk. Or take a picture of yourself. Send us that, outlook@bbc.co.uk. And the email address, the address of the website is bbcworldservice.com/outlook. Now, next year, a group of three American Muslim comedians calling themselves Allah Made Me Funny are planning to tour the Middle East with their stand-up comedy show. Much of their stage material centres around their faith. And here, for example, is Azhar Usman describing how his local mosque interacts with the media.
Now, here's the thing. As I said before, it's a golden opportunity to get our best and brightest in front of the cameras. Instead, we got this guy. No disrespect intended, but for lack of a better word, he's an uncle. Looks like he just rolled out of bed, didn't comb his hair that morning, he's got rice in his beard. Here's my biggest problem with this guy. He can't speak English. Now, let me be perfectly honest with you. I don't really care that you can't speak English. I don't mind. Why do you want TV? You couldn't find anybody better for the job? I like to call this guy Uncle, let me explain you. Because everything he says, he starts out by saying, let me explain you.
U.S. comedian Azhar Usman, whose parents came from India. His colleague, Mo Preacher, is an Afro-Caribbean convert to Islam, while the group's third member, Mo Amir, is a Palestinian who grew up in Kuwait before moving to America with his family. Allah Made Me Funny have just completed a four-week European tour with a show at the U.S. Embassy in London. And that's where Outlook's Siobhan Tai met up with Mo Preacher and Mo Amir.
Ladies and gentlemen, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Allah Made Me Funny, the official Muslim comedy tour, appearing tonight at the United States Embassy in London. Make some noise if you're ready for a good time.
You know, Holland was an amazing experience. That was our first time going into Amsterdam, Rotterdam, and Utrecht, and to have such a dynamic mix of Muslims and non-Muslims was a fantastic experience. That's the goal of Allah Made Me Funny.
The city's like an experiment, man, because they have very low crime, but you have legal prostitution and free marijuana, so.
But it is interesting that you bring up the example of Holland, because your Muslim comedians, if we want to shortcut the description, and you will know that the Netherlands have had its fair share of problems to do with radical Islam. We had the film director who was murdered. We've had outspoken critics of Islam making sure that they protect themselves from putting themselves in danger. How did that history impact on your performance?
Number one, none of those people ever came to the show. And number two, I think the fact that I see it all over. Wherever we go, this has been an issue.
You see it all over. You mean extremism?
On both sides.
Yeah, on both sides.
You can't have one without the other.
And my feelings are bringing Allah Made Me Funny to that environment where you have, you know, politicians in that region speaking so negatively about Islam, it's just going to raise more interest about Allah Made Me Funny.
But it's not just the politicians in that region that are criticizing Islam. It's people who are murdering in the name of Islam.
First of all, I mean, murder is wrong, no matter who does it. But if a white man commits a murder, and to say all white people kill is a wrong statement. If you're going to generalize the entire religion, the entire people who happen to be Muslim, that's wrong.
And then I was referring specifically there to the murder of Van Gogh, the film director. But putting Holland aside, you're a topical comedy show, and I'm talking to you in the week where we're following day-to-day events in Sudan, where a teacher has been accused of insulting Islam and showing contempt for Islam because of this teddy bear that was called Muhammad. How are you going to deal with that in your show?
Call Mo a teddy bear.
Yeah, I'm a teddy bear, and my name is Muhammad. It's ridiculous. I mean, come on. It's a bunch of kids. Kids have this imagination. If the kids want to call the bear Muhammad, it's one of the most popular names in the world, if not the most popular name in the world. It's a ridiculous notion where that's coming from. I think the intentions of the teacher, from what we have seen, is a positive intention. She's in the Sudan, for God's sakes, teaching, where she could be living a life of leisure here in Britain.
So what's your approach to this situation on stage? How are you going to tackle it?
Well, you know, I would find out more information first. Obviously, it's pretty sensitive, so I don't want to get into this thing where I'm out. I would find out more information, but, you know, this whole thing is, you know, an implication of let's throw this religious tract on it. If you didn't like the lady, you didn't like what she did, then you have a right to come to her and say, I didn't like this, or I had a problem with this.
Mo Amir, how far would you go in a joke?
How far would I go in a joke? I mean, I'm not here to be insensitive. You know, I'm a Palestinian, for God's sake. So there's a lot of jokes out there about Palestinians and you know, being refugees. So, I mean, I'm sensitive to these issues. I'm not out here to hurt feelings.
How far have you pushed your audience, though? Can you give me an example of how far you will push it?
I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. I don't
well, you must be able to judge the audience and their reaction.
Yeah,
somewhat.
Absolutely. That's part of being a really good comedian, is that you'll be able to judge your audience and to see which way you want to take them. But I don't see anything offensive in my show. I comment about what's happening with me and my family, having a nephew named Osama. My brother is a pilot. Having a brother who has he's a biochemist when anthrax is coming out. Those are real issues that I dealt with, and I speak about them you know, to show that, hey, you know, there's Arabs and Muslims that happen to be pilots and biochemists, and there are kids named Osama, and, you know, I'm not worried about shocking people and really upsetting somebody. What I'm after is enlightenment.
Yeah, I would challenge that notion of shocking people. There's a difference between shocking people and waking people up.
Mm.
You've toured the UK before, but you're talking to me here at the American Embassy in London. Just how significant is it to be at this venue?
From my own personal experience, born in Kuwait, Palestinian refugee, still had travel with a refugee travel document to be performing at the U.S. Embassy in London is something that I could have never imagined.
But is there any sense that you're aligning with the administration that you might criticize?
The fact is that we're from the States. So, I mean, if they want to use Allah Made Me Funny, which is a positive project for our community, you know, yeah. Why not?
My name is Michael Macy, and I'm the cultural attaché here at the U.S. Embassy in London.
Now, when you came in here and you met up with the comedians, I saw you give them a hug and a kiss three times on the cheek. You've obviously got a rapport there, or you're very fond of these three.
One, professionally, it's always rewarding to work with them. But personally, it's just delightful to work with them. They have a sense of the positive role that comedy plays. One is as a catharsis, that the tradition of stand-up comedy in the U.S. is really it has often been the tool of the outsiders, and rely on an even older tradition, which is the tradition of the medieval tradition of the fool. They reserve the right to speak about anything.
Even 9/11?
Well, I think you have to be able to address what is important in people's lives, and to say, well, it didn't happen, or we can't talk about it, or we can only talk about it in hushed tones. I think what is going on in the world is fair game. I think they have always done it sensitively. I think they have always done it compassionately, because they are compassionate men.
How significant is this venue? Why is it so important that they should play here?
Well, we basically wanted to invite our friends in for a good laugh. I mean, that's what this was all about. It's certainly part of American culture, stand-up comedy. There have been Muslims in America for hundreds of years. These guys are all American.
You're shrugging it off in a very warm-hearted way, but is there something symbolic about them being here?
Oh, I think so. I mean, in that it shows we're more than willing to laugh at ourselves. I mean, I expect, having seen these three perform, that there will be jokes at the expense of the U.S. government, jokes at the expense of the U.S. Embassy, and that's all fine. I mean, we have no control over what they say. We don't discuss it beforehand, and we would never do that. I mean, we know we're opening ourselves up to be the target of some of the jokes.
And meeting two members of the U.S. comic troupe Allah Made Me Funny was Siobhan Tai. A quick update on a previous story before we go. We recently interviewed U.S. property tycoon Donald Trump about his plans to build a luxury golf course in Scotland. We also spoke to a local campaigner who is against that plan. Well, Mr. Trump's planning application has now been rejected by the local council in the northeast of Scotland, but Mr. Trump may still appeal against that decision. He's in a bunker, but he's hoping to get back on the fairway. That's all from Outlook for now. I'm Frederick Dove. Do join me again, same time tomorrow.